Peter B. Collins with news and comment here on Thursday, April 19th, 2012. Rock and roll has lost another great one. The drummer for the band, Levon Helm, has passed away at the age of 71.
See the man with the stage fright, just standing up there to give it all his might. And he got caught in the spotlight. But when we get to the end, you want to start all over again.
Levon Helm didn't really seek the spotlight. He was just laying down a powerful drum line for first Bob Dylan when the band was backup for Mr. Zimmerman, and then when they went solo. And I had a chance to see the band perform once with Bob Dylan and another time without him, and I enjoyed each configuration. I've always been a fan of their music, and in the intervening years since they broke up and stopped making new recordings, I became a big fan of Robbie Robertson, who is quite a talent, a guy who's written a number of great songs for the band and for his own solo albums. And so I just want to acknowledge the passing of Levon Helm and great contributions to music over the years, including songs like The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, Up on Cripple Creek, Ophelia, Rag Mama Rag. And I just think that, well, they made a great contribution to the music that I've enjoyed over the years, and I am grateful for that. In today's in-depth interview at peterbcollins.com, you'll hear a recording of a live broadcast that I did yesterday, sitting in for my friend Brad Friedman of bradblog.com on KPFK in Los Angeles. And it's an interesting two-part. The first part is an interview with John Stauber. John is a longtime anti-corporate activist, and we talk about the group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the damage they've done at the behest of corporate America. Here's an excerpt from that conversation with John Stauber.
This issue of ALEC's role really hit a new level of awareness with the death of Trayvon Martin in Florida
right.
A couple of months ago. Because Trayvon Martin was shot by a gentleman who's now charged with second-degree murder, who in his defense is going to use a stand-your-ground law, which is something ALEC has championed and helped put on the books all over the country, which essentially allows a shooter to pull a trigger if the shooter feels threatened by somebody who is refusing to stand still. So it's very exciting that the center has been able to expose ALEC, and your listeners, if they Google ALEC, and will find lots of articles. And if you Google ALEC and California, I'm sure you'll find articles on the role of ALEC in passing right-wing pro-business legislation in the state of California, too.
Well, and I want to invite listeners to go to prwatch.org. That is the powerful website of the Center for Media and Democracy. And there's quite a bit. We'll talk about some of it with John here in the course of the next few minutes.
And you can hear the full interview over at peterbcollins.com. 17 years ago today, Timothy McVeigh, co-conspirator Terry Nichols, and perhaps others, conspired to detonate homemade explosives, fertilizer, under the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. 168 people were killed, and I believe there was a cover-up. I happen to know one of the investigators who was hired by the defense team, and while they've never been willing to share explicit details, the clear impression I got is that Timothy McVeigh was fingered, and other people who may have conspired with him were never brought to trial. And it's just another one of those murky stories that we may never know the full truth about. But what's interesting as we look back in the intervening 17 years is that over that time, domestic terrorism here in the United States has, by majority, come from right-wing extremists. 56% of terrorist attacks and plots since 1995 have been perpetrated by right-wing extremists. 30% attributed to eco-terrorists, and I have some problem with that. Only 12% attributed to Islamic extremists. And we know that in many of those cases, FBI informants were provocateurs who actually put people up to crimes that they weren't planning to commit. Nevertheless, we still have this specter that 56% of domestic terrorism is homegrown right-wing. And it continues to fester, and in some cases flourish, because we're all focused on hardening our airports to prevent the next terrorist attack. And that certainly won't address the right-wing nuts who are on the loose with often automatic weapons and other armaments that make them extremely dangerous. And that's just another case of the misdirection that our government takes in the name of security. Another anniversary, a murky one, that we observed 2 years ago, Tuesday, was when the blowout in the Gulf began, the Macondo well, creating the biggest environmental catastrophe, I believe, in world history. And it's important to note that in the intervening 2 years, the U.S. Congress has done absolutely nothing. In fact, we are drilling again at the same rates that we did before the blowout in the Gulf. And there appears to be no need to learn any lessons. It's just drill, baby, drill, and oops, we spill a little bit, who cares? And I think it's tragic, because we have a Democratic president who could have led a charge on this, could have really shamed the Congress into taking significant action to prevent this kind of a debacle in the future. And a group of environmentalists have issued a grade to Congress, a grade of D, for doing nothing. And I think we have to apply the same grade to the Democrats who don't control the House right now, and to the White House for their stunning inaction. And Chloe, my radio dog, is very upset by this. She's piping up right now, as you might be able to hear. And another disastrous anniversary that we observe here in San Francisco, the 1906 earthquake occurred on April 18th, and that would be 106 years ago. We have learned a few lessons, and we retrofit our buildings. We live with that legacy on a regular basis. And the blowout in the Gulf was a much bigger disaster. And again, it's shameful that our government just considers it business as usual. I often have critical comments about the senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. She's registered as a Democrat and often, to my chagrin, votes with Republicans. But I once again have to single her out for credit, because in the wake of the Trayvon Martin shooting and what we have disclosed here and others have reported on in detail about the role of ALEC in promoting the NRA's legislation, Senator Feinstein has put a formal hold on proposed legislation in the United States Senate that would essentially establish reciprocity for people who have a concealed carry permit. So if I've got a permit from Idaho that says I'm allowed to have a concealed weapon, this would basically require all other states to recognize that. And it limits their ability to control who's got a gun and where they are with it and whether they could use it in a public place. So I give the senator credit. She wrote a letter to Harry Reid, the majority leader, said these dangerous bills opposed by leading law enforcement organizations would undermine states' rights by forcing nearly every state to accept the concealed carry permits issued by other states, even if the permit holder could not qualify for a permit in the state to which he is traveling. I respectfully place a hold on these bills and request that you do not allow them to be considered on their own or as an amendment to other legislation. And Senator Feinstein's up for re-election this year. She has very light opposition from Republicans, no primary challenge from Democrats. The only real challenge she faces is that her campaign finance director stole $5 million from her account and those of other politicians. And the Federal Elections Commission has said that she cannot go back to the same donors and ask them to contribute again because they've already maxed out to her campaign, and it's not the donor's fault that Feinstein's money was stolen. Yesterday, I mentioned Senator Mark Leno, a state senator here in California, who represents the district where I live, and a man I truly admire. He's rather low-key, but he does a lot of really good work, and his latest is a bill that he has introduced in the California State Senate in response to the recent Supreme Court decision that essentially says that any suspect who is booked into a jail or lockup may be strip-searched, and it gives wide deference to law enforcement to determine if a strip search is advisable. So the senator has written a bill that would sharply limit that. And here's a quote from Mark Leno. A sexual assault victim or a person who has been detained for a minor crime, such as having unpaid parking tickets, should not have to suffer the invasion of privacy and humiliation of a strip search without a compelling reason. His bill ensures that detainees are given adequate time to arrange their release before they're subjected to extreme jailhouse procedures. And this appears to be something that is not in violation of the Supreme Court decision, but does put local and sensible restrictions on the strip search policies. Another piece of legislation introduced in the State Senate in Sacramento would require an agency like BART, the subway system here in the Bay Area, to get a court order before they could shut down cellular phone networks. And this is in response to an event last August where BART, in a sneaky way, shut down cell phone service to prevent protesters, and this is really before the Occupy movement surfaced. But there were protesters who were upset over the killing of a man at a BART platform in downtown San Francisco. So they staged a march, and in a preemptive way, BART turned off the cell service to prevent them from communicating either by voice or text while they were on BART's public property. And this produced a real backlash and concern over constitutional issues, and we have to give credit to State Senator Alex Padilla, who is the author of this bill, to sharply limit this kind of action in the future, requiring a court order. Also, out-of-control cops over at UC Davis last November who used military-grade pepper spray on peaceful protesters who were lying passively on the ground. It's produced the resignation, or in fact, the early retirement of the campus cop's chief of police. Her name is Annette Spicuzza, and she is going to take the fall here. They're trying to protect the chancellor of the university, Linda Katehi, and she has resisted calls for her resignation. But I think it would be a good idea, Chancellor. Why don't you move on to some other job opportunity? Also in the news today, the average Fortune 500 CEO in the United States is now making 380 times as much as the average worker. And it just continues. This gap continues to widen. Last year, it was a mere 343 times the average worker. Now it's up to 380, and that equates to about a 14% increase in executive pay over the past year. Meanwhile, a couple of corporate billionaires are duking it out in a San Francisco courtroom. It pits Oracle against Google, and it has to do with alleged patent violations by Google in its creation of the Android smartphone platform. And it's pretty interesting to see Larry Ellison, a billionaire, and then Larry Page, billionaire CEO of Google, show up for these photo ops and go into the courtroom. And so far, I can't personally evaluate the legitimacy of Google's defense against this $6 billion claim from Oracle. But there were 7 patents in question originally. It's now down to 1. And they are arguing over whether Google needed to get a license from Oracle to use Java technology because Oracle had purchased Sun Microsystems, which controlled Java. And Larry Page said, no, we looked into it and we decided we didn't need a license to use what they consider to be, I guess, open source elements of Java. So it's hard to have sympathies for either side, frankly. We will not win, no matter who is declared the victor in this particular episode. Meanwhile, in New Delhi, India announced it had successfully launched a missile with nuclear capability and a range of 3,100 miles, giving it the ability to strike Beijing and Shanghai. And I just want to point out that India is a nuclear weapons power. The Bush administration bent over backwards to give India a pass on non-proliferation issues and created a separate set of rules for India, which I opposed at the time. And I want to point out that we have all this drama about whether Iran will develop a nuclear weapon. They don't have one, and everybody knows it. There's also concern that Iran might develop a missile capable of carrying a nuclear weapon, and so far, they don't have that either. And in the last couple of weeks, there was all this international concern about North Korea. And what North Korea did was fire off the equivalent of a bottle rocket. And it broke up even before it became suborbital. They were trying to launch a satellite. And, you know, these are people who are flexing big dicks, if you'll pardon that expression. And the hypocrisy and the inconsistency of American positions and those of our allies is just so clear. That because we consider India to be a relatively benign member of the nuclear club, that they can have bombs and they can have missiles, and there is not a critical word uttered. But Iran, North Korea, completely different standards. Reaction to what we reported on yesterday, the grisly photos that were taken 2 years ago by troops of the 82nd Airborne serving in Afghanistan. And this is ugly stuff. It's the kind of grandstanding that does happen, I'm afraid to say, in a war zone. And these are pictures of American soldiers posing with body parts of opponents they have killed. And it's ugly. It's embarrassing. And it's just another negative issue for the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. What I deplore is that the Obama administration went to great pains to persuade the Los Angeles Times not to publish these photos. And after they were published, I heard a military or retired general on the PBS NewsHour, and I'm sorry I don't have his name in front of me, who was saying, gosh, why did they have to do this? This is inconvenient. And he was suggesting that the LA Times should have suppressed these photographs because it's not helpful to the U.S. position. Well, I'm sorry. What you're suggesting, sir, is not helpful to my First Amendment rights and to the obligation of our government to be honest with the American people. And I just think that we've come to a point now where control of the media, based on the perceived or the projected interests of our government, is just okay with people. Yeah, sure, we shouldn't do anything that might rock the boat or anything that might hurt the United States in its occupation of Afghanistan. Well, I reject that and say, I'm sorry. That's not how it works here, and I don't care who's in the White House. Finally today in our podcast, we also feature a review of the new film called Bully by our official film reviewer, Gary Chu. And I wanted to note that a young man in New Jersey who was bullied even after he sent emails and created a paper trail of the abuse that he was receiving at school as a 12-year-old. His name is Rosenstein, Sawyer Rosenstein. And as a middle school student, he was bullied and beaten up and now is confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. A jury awarded him $4.2 million in damages for the incident. And basically what I'm picking up here is that the school district was held liable but was permitted to make this settlement without admitting fault or liability. And at least in the case of young Sawyer Rosenstein, I hope that there is some solace in the recognition that he was abused at school. Hey, thanks for joining me for today's news and comment. Spread it far and wide. This podcast is free.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.